Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host today. We've got a live show for you here from Campbell Hall on the WILL campus. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today we're going to be talking about media, of course, but we're also going to be taking on some of the big themes and some of the broader issues in media today. The past several years, we've seen an onslaught of the argument that the United States enjoys a very liberal news media biased against political conservatives, the military, and business. And it's recently met a challenge, a very strong challenge in the form of a number of commentators. Eric Alterman has been a guest here. Ed Herman has been a guest on the show. Likewise, our guest today, David Sirota, is someone who is part of the sort of return volley to the critique of the liberal media. David Sirota has worked in progressive politics and campaigns for his entire career. He recently took a position as a communications worker for the Center for American Progress, a new progressive think tank in Washington, D.C. Before that, David Sirota worked for the U.S. House Appropriations Committee, the committee responsible for most federal spending. And even before that, and where I got to know David Sirota, he was a spokesperson for Representative Bernard Sanders of Vermont, the House's only independent and the leading progressive voice in the United States. Sirota is a working journalist. He writes a column that's frequently published in places like the Baltimore Sun, the Progressive Populist, Common Dreams, and TomPaine.com, among others. David Sirota, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks. Good to be here, Bob.
It's a real pleasure to have you here. And for our listeners who are unfamiliar with David Sirota, he writes widely on a broad range of political issues. So really the whole playing field is open for discussion today on political issues and on media coverage. The number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And let's start, David, by just telling folks a little bit. You work now for the Center for American Progress. What is that? How long has it been around? What's its purpose?
The Center for American Progress just sort of opened its doors about a month or two ago. It was originally conceived and continues to be conceived of as an attempt to counter what has been a 20-year, or we would argue a 20-year surge to the right, fueled by an entire conservative infrastructure in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country. Currently in Washington, you have about 300-plus conservative think tanks and organizations operating to push the political debate farther to the right than is probably most people are comfortable with in the United States. That's been done through billions and billions of dollars. The center that I work at is an attempt to sort of beef up the other side's intellectual and communications infrastructure. We are a nonpartisan research and educational organization. We're not about Democrat or Republican. We're about progressive versus conservative, and obviously we are on the progressive side of that. So it's going to encompass a lot of different things, but it's very exciting. It's headed by John Podesta, who was President Clinton's most recent and final chief of staff before he left the White House. So we're looking forward to a really vigorous debate with the right and trying to pull the debate back to where most people are comfortable with it being.
Now, I saw somewhere on the web the group described as being connected to President Clinton himself. Is there a connection with Bill Clinton with this group?
No, there is not. There's been rumors that we're connected with Senator Hillary Clinton or President Clinton. I think the answer to that I know the answer to that is absolutely not. There are, you know, some people who worked in the Clinton administration, but there's also, you know, people like me who started my work with Bernie Sanders, who is an independent. And we're going to have, I think in the next couple of weeks, there's going to be an announcement that one or two of our fellows are actually come out of the Republican Party. So, again, it's not about Democrat, Republican, Clinton, non-Clinton. It's about people who are committed to progressive politics and reinvigorating those politics throughout the country.
Now, I know one of the pieces you've written recently, or this is just about to come out, deals with the vision of what role government should play in our society. And I think one of the big changes that you talked about really at the outset in American political culture from the 30s to the 60s to the 70s and then on into the past two decades has been the view of what the role of government should be, can be, in our political culture, from being one that for decades was seen as a progressive role in which government could solve problems and make life better for people, to a view of seeing government largely as a negative force that usually just screws things up and gets in the way of people and should basically be limited in what it does. What's your take on government? Where do you come down on it, and where do you think it should be?
Well, I think that there's two things to think about. One, the right wing has spent the better part of 20 or 30 years trying to make people forget that what government should be in its most ideal sense, and what it actually is the reflection of the society, at least a democratic government is. It's the people. It is supposed to be an organization that operates on behalf of people. So however, in that respect, however efficiently or adequately government operates is a reflection really on how efficiently and effectively society is operating. Now, that's what government is supposed to be. Unfortunately, what it has become is something that responds mainly to large corporate interests and does not respond to the people. You've seen that with the FCC decision earlier this year. You see that with our tax policies. You see it with our trade policies. Most of the policies that the federal government today produces are ones that enrich large, wealthy institutions and do not do much for the average person. So what's strange is you had 20 or 30 years of the right wing vilifying government, trying to make it be this thing that messes all these things up. What they've actually done is they've vilified it to the average person while turning it into a tool for the large wealthy interests that fund their campaigns. So my personal opinion is that's not what the government should be doing. The government, we should return or try to seek a situation where the government is more responsive to the people, does things for the average person. I mean, the question everyone should have on their minds is, when is the last time something came out of Washington that actually did something and did something right for the average person? And the answer is not for a long time. And it's not because the government has messed something up. Most of the time it's because what's coming out of the government in the first place is something that does not help or affect or do anything for the average person.
Now, in this piece, you talk about how the news media have done a very poor job of sort of explaining this to the American people and have sort of accepted the dominant framing of the conservatives. But at the same time, we see books by people like Sean Hannity and Ann Coulter and Bernard Goldberg, and the list goes on and on, and commentators like Rush Limbaugh talking about how the news media, in fact, are people like yourselves, people on the political left who like big, aggressive government with aggressive policies and lots of spending and high taxes. What's the story here? Is the media made up of people like you with your viewpoints that's critical of all this, or is the media sympathetic to the conservative position?
I think that what you've got is you've got these right-wing folks know that the more they vilify the media as a tool, a quote-unquote tool of the left wing, the more they inoculate any honest look at the corporate policies that their side is producing. It's just another form of political warfare, really. It's the same thing as airing a campaign ad against a political opponent. Vilifying the media attempts to basically injure their ability to be an honest referee. And right now, we don't have an honest referee. So what the result is, you spend 20 years vilifying the media as being liberal, and then any time the media tries to tell a story honestly, the right wing just tries to play it off as something, as just more liberal media propaganda. Now, the facts, beget what's really going on. The media is far more conservative on fundamental economic issues than mainstream America. The media, think about how many, for instance, this is a good example, think about how many business shows are on television and in the newspaper and on radio. Business shows talk only about corporate profits. When was the last time anyone heard on, let's say, CNN, a review of the stock market and then talking about how working conditions are being affected by changes in the economy? You don't hear that. Now, that is a fundamentally conservative decision to make from an economic standpoint. You are covering what affects the upper crust of CEOs and executives in America, and you're not covering, for instance, what it's like, what the conditions are like for the average person working in America. So that's just one example.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to David Sirota today as our guest on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. David Sirota works for the Center for American Progress, a progressive think tank in Washington, D.C., a new one. He's been active in politics, working on the staff of Congressman Bernard Sanders from Vermont. And he's been a journalist and is a journalist and a writer who writes widely for publications like the Progressive Populist, Common Dreams, and the Baltimore Sun. If you'd like to call in and speak with David Sirota, ask him a question or have a comment, the number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And we're going to go to our toll-free line right now. Terre Haute, welcome to Media Matters. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air, sir.
Yeah. My name's Ron Nelson, and I have a question for your guest here. I don't know where he gets off saying, or the gist of the comments being made that the progressive press is in the minority, when you consider the media as both not just radio or television, but print and Hollywood. When you take it all in consideration, the progressive press still has a great voice out there. And I think most of America is reacting to that by turning away from it because it's not addressing the needs of the average person out there. Maybe your guest there can comment on the
caller, can
overall.
Caller, let me just ask you to elaborate one thing. By Hollywood, you mean sort of like the TV shows and entertainment programs have a liberal bias?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's quite obvious they do. I mean, I don't think you can say they don't. It's not just Hollywood. It's the print media. It's the public television, public radio, this very program itself.
Does your newspaper have, in your community, have a liberal bias?
Well, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from St. Louis, and the paper there is definitely liberal.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised in California. I don't think you can find a conservative paper out there. You know,
are there? Do you have access to any conservative viewpoints in your media that you consume, or are you unable to find them?
No, I have to go to I can't really find them in the mainstream media. I have to go to alternative means. I have to go to, the talk shows. I have to go to the newer outlets, Fox, that sort of thing. Those haven't been around that long. Fox is recent.
Mm-hmm.
So all this recent change or gain, if you want to call it that, for the conservative side, I believe, is because the liberal or progressive press has not addressed the true needs of the public. Otherwise, we wouldn't have Fox.
All right. David Sirota, heart of the media are liberal, he says. What do you say?
Let me respond to that. I think there's sort of something going on underneath that isn't talked about very much. And I tried to allude to it at the beginning. I would say that on some very touchy social issues where people feel very passionately about, there is a case to be made that mainstream journalists probably have a very moderate position. They're not a lot of. I would agree. There's probably not a lot of social conservatives among most mainstream journalists. I would say, however, that this is the thing that we need to really think about: the core economic issues, the pocketbook issues that fundamentally affect all Americans each and every day they go to work. It's very hard to dispute that what you have is a conservative media, meaning the choices of stories that are being written, how the stories are being written, what they're being written about. I'll give you, here's a great example. An objective media, I would think, would be writing almost every day about the fact that 50 million Americans do not have health insurance and that this country spends the most on health care per capita in the industrialized world. So again, we spend the most on health care in the industrialized world, and we have the highest amount of unemployed citizens, uninsured citizens in the industrialized world. It would seem to me that not even a liberal media, but a objective media would write stories day after day after day. I mean, one in six Americans cannot afford to get the health care they need potentially to stay alive. What do we hear instead? We hear stories about how the tax cuts are going to help the economy. We hear stories about how a fundamental assumption in most major media press is that the best way to reform healthcare is to go through the private market, despite the fact that statistics after statistics after statistics show that the private insurance market wastes 30 cents on the dollar on healthcare. So again, it's much more underlying. It's the choice of stories that you're seeing on fundamental economic issues. And you know, I'll allude back to the fact that you don't hear many stories about working conditions in America for the average worker. You don't hear stories about how the income gap is growing at a faster pace now than it ever has been growing in American history. These are conservative decisions. These are decisions to not cover these things serves the interests of large corporate interests.
Caller, do you want to respond to that?
Well, yeah, I would just say that there's plenty of progressive media out there that could cover that, and evidently they have chosen not to do that.
So if they don't cover it, how can they be progressive if those are progressive issues?
That's a good question. Why aren't they covering it? They are progressive. The progressive, you mean the L.A. Times is not progressive? You don't see banner headlines on the healthcare problem down there. They're not pushing that, and the reason for that is because the interests of the people are presently not on the healthcare issue, although I agree with your commenter there that we need to discuss that, but that's because both the liberal and the conservative press have ignored it.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. Even the press that we call quote unquote liberal, the fact that the editorial decisions are being made to exclude stories and include others, that is where the biggest power of the media exists. What are we covering? What are we not covering? And I would argue that the boundaries for what is considered quote-unquote coverable and what is considered not coverable, those boundaries have been set by a corporate conservative interest. And why have they been decided by that? Because most of the major media outlets in this country are owned by large corporate interests. So, you know, to a certain extent, it's hard to expect that a huge corporation is going to be producing stories that deal with questions about whether they're paying their workers fairly. So ultimately, we have a fundamental problem where we have large corporations who have a stake in what they're covering economic issues.
Caller, do you want to say anything more?
Well, I would just say that's where NPR should take up the banner, and I think they do a good job of getting it out. But as long as we have a free enterprise system that even impacts the progressive press, you're going to have that trouble because they have to have advertisers. And the commenters is correct in that matter. I would say, though, that the media still is more progressive than it is conservative. I'll stick with that. I do have to look for the conservative point of view. I can't just go to any place on my dial. I have to be very selective to find the conservative slant in the media. And, you know, to sit there and start this conversation off with that we've lost control of as progressives, I think you're wrong.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling.
All right.
All right. Well, David Sirota, that was a nice exchange there, and I think that's a common viewpoint. That's not an argument that you haven't heard, I suspect, and we hear it on this show quite often.
Right.
And, you know, I think you touch on it, this idea that, you know, entertainment programming especially, because there's programming that favors liberal viewpoints, certainly in social issues over conservative. But even there, it's sort of an interesting mix because somehow, oftentimes, vulgarity is called liberal programming.
That's right. Well, that's one interesting area that I don't think has been exploited nearly enough by people who look at media issues is the idea that you've got, let's just take Fox, which I think most people would agree has at the very least a right-of-center viewpoint in its news coverage.
You know, in fact, just to interject here, in their lawsuit with Al Franken, Fox News basically conceded that in their legal
papers.
That's right.
And I would say that what's interesting is that they attract quote-unquote conservatives, yet they're also airing some of the most vulgar reality shows and sort of anti-family values shows out there, poisoning, some could argue, poisoning the culture with a sort of degradation of values. So it's a strange dichotomy. You're attracting conservative viewers or viewers who say they're conservatives through news coverage to a network that is spewing sort of cultural garbage out there.
We're talking to David Sirota today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. David Sirota is a journalist and a writer who's written widely on a broad range of political subjects. He's a progressive, and he works for the new group, the Center for American Progress. And we're talking about the whole gamut of issues on the show today. If you want to call in, the number is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. David, following up on this issue of the liberal bias, the media versus conservative or corporate bias, one of the core ways to measure this would be the way the press, the national press, the political press has covered, say, the Clinton administration versus the George W. Bush administration, and Clinton personally and George W. Bush personally. I think a hallmark of the critique that people have made of liberal media is that it's been extremely sympathetic to people like Bill Clinton, who I don't know if anyone would really consider much of a progressive, but certainly a Democrat, and much harder on conservative politicians like George W. Bush. What's your sense, being a political junkie, of how the press has handled those two presidents?
Well, I think that you know, let's go over the facts here. You had hundreds, if not probably thousands, of stories about Whitewater and his affair with Monica Lewinsky. Whitewater was found to be basically not a case. The Monica Lewinsky situation, was a personal, indiscretion that ended up being escalated into a court battle and then an impeachment case. Hundreds, if not thousands, of stories about that. President Bush, on the other hand, has basically acknowledged, and his staff has basically acknowledged, that they misled America about the facts about why we had to go to war in Iraq. That has gotten probably, I would say, 50 to 100 stories. So if that, it has been also a three-week story, and now it's not talked about. So one president, whether you like him or not, was vilified month after month, year after year, on a court case that turned out to be nothing and a personal indiscretion. Another president led the entire country into a war, which we're now losing 2 or 3 troops a day. We're stuck in a quagmire, and he's going to offer a budget request for $80 billion more to pay for this war. We went in there on false pretenses, and that's barely a story now. Now, you tell me what kind of bias the media has. You know, it's hard to ignore those facts. I mean, those are simple facts.
Now,
go ahead.
Now, how much of that, David, do you think is due to the press or the press's reliance on official sources? And since when Clinton had Republicans all over Capitol Hill jumping up and down constantly attacking him on these grounds, journalists had lots of material. But Democrats haven't been as feisty in their response to President Bush for whatever reason.
Well, there's two sides of that equation. One, the Democrats on Capitol Hill do not have the structural power necessary to push forward investigations and the like that the Republicans had during Clinton, because the Democrats are not in the majority. You need to be in the majority in order to call hearings, in order to subpoena documents, in order to do all of the legally binding things to get to the bottom of dishonesty. So there's a problem there. The second part of this, I think, is that it's a much more, I would say, sexy story to discuss a quote-unquote shady land deal or a sexual sort of affair. That's much sexier, I think, at least to a journalist, to talk about how intelligence data was mishandled.
Now let me flank you from the other side here with this question then. If that's sexy, why wasn't George W. Bush's Harkin dealing sexy as Whitewater? Certainly that is as interesting a story as Whitewater on those grounds.
Well, because I think that, so you've got the sort of sexy, not sexy issue.
Mm-hmm.
On the Bush issue, I also think what you've got going specifically for him is, and this is reflected in polls, and it's very interesting, the public essentially accepts the fact that this administration, it comes from corporate America, comes from the heart, from a sort of sketchy side of business. They come from big oil. the public accepts that. So simply stating that President Bush or Vice President Cheney did X, Y, and Z when they were CEO of Harkin and Halliburton, respectively, I don't think is as much of a shocking story because, again, the public accepts that. I do think, however, that when it does become a story, and even the mainstream media reports it when it becomes a story, is when you connect where they came from, where they got their money to fund their election, with what they are actually doing. So you see that in some of the environmental coverage of late, where some of their biggest donors were energy companies, and they're subsequently deregulating air pollution laws to sort of pay those industries back. That's when I think you do see a story. But again, I think simply pointing out that George Bush or Dick Cheney had oil dealings or weren't exactly forthright in their business dealings prior to being in the White House, I think that's already sort of publicly accepted as sort of just a fact of life.
Okay, we're talking to David Sirota today on Media Matters. The number here, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We've got a caller. Let's go to the lines now. Charleston, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Hi. I just have a couple of comments relevant to the earlier caller, the discussion with the earlier caller from Terre Haute. First, just as an aside, I'd like to praise you, Bob, for the tremendously excellent job you do of welcoming and encouraging open debate on the show from between diverse points of view. I thought that was an excellent exchange you had. One thing I'd like to know, well, first I'd just like to list some other stories that aren't covered outside of the social arena. You mentioned, your guest mentioned a bunch of economic stories, and on the environmental front, there are enormous environmental stories that any honest press, I think, would also be covering every day. For example, recent research shows that fish stocks in the oceans are down in many cases by 90%, and the oceans are in crisis, you know, which is a sort of a linchpin of our very survival. There have been stories that are partially economic about pollution control industries facing almost no new orders with the current Bush environmental policy, so whole industries that promote environmental quality may be going down the drain or suffering. And there are a number of stories like that. Oh, agricultural stories. Recently it was reported that the grain crop in Ukraine has decreased from 21 billion bushels of wheat last year to 5 billion bushels this year due to the heat wave in Europe, and that's true throughout Europe, and grain stocks per capita are the lowest they've been in 30 years. So there are a huge number of other stories. I just sort of wanted to add to the list there.
Okay, and did you want David to sort of give his assessment?
Sure.
Okay.
I think they're all interesting stories, and I think that the way that I think about them, and it's unfortunate that it's come to this, but the way that I think about all of them is we need to start looking at who is making money off of what's being covered and what's not being covered. Who is making money off of what the government is doing and what the government is not doing? The question, I mean, on all of these issues, you take the extra step. You say, well, on environmental issues, the government's not doing anything. They're not doing anything. Why are they not doing something? Well, it would help most of the people, let's say, living around toxic waste sites if they accelerated Superfund cleanups. Instead, they're terminating the Superfund program. Why is the government doing that? Well, because in order to fund the Superfund program, there's a tax on corporations to pay into the Superfund to make sure those things get paid. So if we end the program, large corporate polluters won't have to pay the money anymore. You'll increase their bottom line. So this is the way that I think that people need to start thinking about what's going on. And you know, there's probably a sort of a mental block there. We don't want to actually admit to ourselves that what's going on is money comes into campaigns and then federal decisions are made in accordance with that. But the fact is, on every one of these stories you look at, this is what's going on. And additionally, the coverage now is being driven by this. Corporations own media companies. That means the media is fundamentally not going to cover proposals or problems that fundamentally go after corporate irresponsibility or corporate issues. So I think that on all of these instances, we need to just condition ourselves to say, hey, who's making money off this decision, or who's making money off this decision not to cover this story?
Well, you know, David, sort of what can we do if, and once we've done this analysis and we find out, and we're going to go through some of these stories in the balance of the show, but in healthcare, in the environment, in foreign policy, that moneyed interests dominate so much of the policies, and also the nature of the coverage in the commercial media, or all the media, perhaps, for that matter. What can people listening to this show do? What are you trying to do to help change the situation?
Well, what I think there's two things. We can, one, I think part of my role is to try to help identify it where it's happening. So that's part of one of my what people can do. This is actually American politics is very complex, but at a certain level, it's very simple. Some of the most successful organizations at affecting the political debate are totally grassroots organizations. If you get 20 or 30 people from, for instance, a House member's district to meet with that member of the House, and all 30 people say, we're meeting with you for this reason, we find this to be unacceptable, we will be holding you accountable if you vote this way on a bill coming up that deals with whatever issue it is you're dealing with, you will see that member of Congress think twice about whether they're going to go to bat for the people or whether they're going to go to bat for their corporate donors.
Mm-hmm.
It's across the board, because ultimately the last preserve of American democracy still exists in the fact that corporations and everyone can spend a whole lot of money on elections, but bottom line is, a member of Congress stays in office or doesn't stay in office based on whether they get enough votes. So the real power that people still have, and it takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of work to organize people, but the real power people have is to make a collective statement to all of their elected representatives about given issues. And they have to do it in a collective way, they have to do it in an organized way, and they have to do it in a way that's narrow enough so that member of Congress or that county commissioner or that city councilman knows that if I vote a certain way, I am being watched, and I'm being watched by the people.
I'm talking to David Schroeder today on Media Matters. I'm the host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Let me tell you who our guests are going to be in the upcoming shows. The next 4 weeks, we will have live shows with the following guests: Danny Schechter, who's been here before, the news dissector, prominent broadcast and print journalist for 30 years, author of several books talking about the Iraq War and the coverage of the Iraq War, about which he has a new book. 2 weeks from today, a personal favorite, Jim Boughton, the author of Ball 4, the legendary baseball pitcher and author, here to discuss his new book, Foul Ball, and discuss his battles with a local newspaper monopolist in western Massachusetts as he tried to save an old historic landmark baseball ballpark. 3 weeks from today, John Wilson, someone known to many of the listeners, who's an activist from Norma Bloomington, is going to be here. And 4 weeks from today, someone who probably needs less of an introduction than anyone we've ever had, joining us in the show will be Noam Chomsky, to talk basically about politics and anything you would all like to talk to him about. If you'd like to call in right now, again, the number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. Champaign, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Yeah, I'd like to ask your guest about how the media is doing with covering the kind of deceptions that are coming out of the White House, the administration, about the environment and about science, the spin and the lies and the deliberate policy of deception about, global warming or other scientific issues, and the fact that we really aren't that well educated about science, and we're under so much pressure and so much time constraint with our work and our families that most people really are not in a position to keep up or to be able to see how they're being deceived.
Well, I would say that what's gone on, I think if you go on the internet or you look around at the media, you'll find a good number of stories that outline a lot of the discrepancies and inequities generally with what's coming out of the White House and specifically with what's coming out of the federal government on science policy. The problem is And here's really what the problem is. It's like trying to take a drink, a sip of water, from a fire hose. And what I mean by that is there have been so many stories and so much coverage and so many instances of the White House and the federal government saying one thing and then doing another that it has ceased, unfortunately, to be what I guess editors would consider a quote-unquote big story. So I'll sort of trace it here. So President Bush campaigned on the idea that he was going to be an education president, and he proposed an education bill. That was a big deal. And then weeks after that, he came back with his education budget that left his education bill essentially unfunded, or at least underfunded by tens of billions of dollars. So there you've got a great case of, you know, they said one thing, they did another thing. It got a big story. Okay. Cut to, you know, a month later. You've got the global warming situation. The White House admits that it essentially cut out or doctored pieces of an EPA report about global warming to make it seem as if the government wasn't acknowledging that global warming existed, even though scientific consensus says that, at the very least, global warming could exist. So there was a story, but it wasn't as big a story, because what they've done is they've gotten the media conditioned to accept the fact that lying and dishonesty is just a part of the government.
And that, as you put it earlier, the American people expect it and don't mind it.
Well, that's exactly right. I think, and what this does is it blurs coverage. But the worst part about this, it hurts our democracy, because what you're doing by that is you're building up a baseline foundation of cynicism, of people, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, basically saying, I'm not going to trust what the government says because I'm being lied to all the time. I know I'm being lied to, so why should I take the time to go vote? Why should I take the time to even follow what's going on? Because it's all going to be lies anyway. When the fact is, if we stood up and said, hey, I'm not going to accept these kinds of lies. We're not going to accept this kind of dishonesty. We want a more responsive government. You would see a far more responsive government. But, you know, as one of your future guests, Noam Chomsky, who you're going to have on, he talks a lot about how this is part of the reason why this happens from people in power is if you keep people feeling isolated, if you keep people feeling like they have no power and that they have no interest in what their government is doing for them, you essentially keep them helpless. It's like the famous sign that Ben Franklin had, join or die. And what that meant is the people either have to work collectively or their collective interests will die.
We're talking to David Sirota. Let's go back to the phone lines. Urbana, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Hello. Two comments. Actually, one's a question, one's a comment. On the previous subject about just the monstrous amount of lies coming out of the White House, never seen anything like it. I'm 35, never seen anything like it. Asking about how people take it and don't do anything, there's an organization called Move On. I believe their website is moveon.org, and they have attacked in small ways in various places this type of thing. I think it's useful to check out their website. Maybe join one of their writing campaigns. Anyway, the real reason I called was a question about there was an energy policy meeting that was kept very secret. This was before 9/11, and Bush administration refused to disclose any information about this meeting. And a couple weeks ago, I saw on Bill Moyer's show, now at the very end of the show, something I never heard before. He basically said that a journalist had followed this, got some of the a transcript from the meeting, I guess, and that they were talking about maps of Iraq in this meeting. Did I understand this correctly? Do you know anything about this? That's all.
I hadn't heard the story. I didn't see it, so I can't really comment on it. What I guess I can, I'm glad you brought up the energy issue. That's another piece of this, is that not only do you essentially flood the system with dishonesty to make people cynical and to hide what you're really doing, but when you actually can physically hide what you're really doing, meaning you don't just hide the perception of what you're doing, but you actually hide what you're doing, that also keeps people feeling like they have no stake, no power, no interest in their government. The energy situation that the caller was referring to was the White House road and energy policy.
This was 2 years ago?
Correctly. 2 years ago, Vice President Cheney headed up the writing of the administration's energy bill. And when congressional lawmakers asked to see who consulted with the White House in writing that bill, the White House refused to release any documentation of those meetings, despite the fact that those meetings were done on the public dime.
And this, I might add, for listeners unfamiliar with the story, is the first time in American history this had ever taken place. There had been a refusal to share these sorts of documents.
That's right, Bob. And it was so outrageous that the General Accounting Office of Congress, a nonpartisan arm with a chairman of the GAO as a Republican appointee, filed a lawsuit in court to try to get the documents so that the American public could know, at the very least, who was writing the White House's energy policy. And to this point, the White House continues to stonewall. So, again, hiding things, classifying documents, all of this kind of thing, what does it create at the very end? What does it do to the people? It says to the people, you are not important, you have no power, you have no stake, and we are going to do things the way we want to do them on behalf of who we want to do them on behalf of, whether you like it or not. And what that creates is a total cynicism in whether our country and our government serves the people.
You know, David, I'm going to have Danny Schechter on next week, and we're going to be talking almost the entire program about the war in Iraq. But I think it's so important that it's worth mentioning today. You probably saw the poll that came out, I believe, yesterday or the day before from the Washington Post,
mm-hmm.
that shows that 70% of Americans believe that Saddam Hussein was responsible or partially responsible for the 9/11 attacks on the World
right.
Trade Center, despite the fact there's no evidence to that. In fact, there's no credible case to be made for that whatsoever, any more than the government of Canada was connected to these attacks. Yet 70% of the American people believe that. Considering that Americans get all their information via the news media on an issue like this, I mean, not many people are doing their own research on these sorts of issues. What does that tell us? I mean, how did you respond when you saw that story?
Well, the way I responded was that you've got such a totally, basically, depoliticized. You've got a depoliticized society by the fact that, again, the society is essentially and in many ways rightfully cynical that the government really tells the truth or basically is out to serve them. So you've got a depoliticized society that turned on the television and tried to become politicized or at least politically informed on September 11th. And it was a very impressionable moment on September 11th. The society woke up, turned on the television, and, you know, I'm not trying to say that people are some sort of automatons. I think people are very smart to be depoliticized in the current situation, or not smart, but it's a logical conclusion for a working person to say, I don't have enough time to follow the government because I've got such other problems that I don't really believe what they're telling me anyway. But going back to my point, so this depoliticized society wakes up on September 11th at a very impressionable moment, and as the Washington Post story sort of traced through, everything that people in positions of authority said in the administration was, this is the work of Arab terrorists, al-Qaeda, and essentially implying that it was Saddam Hussein was behind it. I mean, there was a CBS News story that came out a couple months ago that said that the planning to go to war, if you can believe this, the planning to go to war in Iraq started on September 11th, even though the Pentagon knew that there was no evidence linking September 11th to Iraq. So this was a preconceived war from the beginning. And some would argue, and I think it's a fair argument to at least discuss, is whether September 11th was calculatedly used as a pretext to wage a totally separate war, and why, and then the questions that come from that. Why would it be used to wage a totally separate war? Well, look, there's oil over in Iraq. Halliburton and Bechtel, two big corporations that have funded the Bush-Cheney campaign, and you know, Halliburton is Vice President Cheney's previous employer. They're making millions, if not billions, in Iraq. All of these questions haven't been asked. They still have it. They're no one's really raising them. The media, at the very least, needs to be raising them. I mean, the whole question of did we go to war in Iraq for corporate profit? That question has not been asked.
Okay, we're talking to David Sirota, and we've got a couple callers I want to get to before we end the program today. So let's go Chicago. You're on the air with David Sirota.
Hello. I just have a quick comment to share following up with the caller who just called right now, talking about a story that briefly appeared on Now regarding maps of Iraq. Just to let everyone know, there's an organization, a legal activist organization out of D.C. I think they're called Judicial Watch. Judicialwatch.org is their website. They apparently sued the White House and successfully won some documents regarding some internal planning. There was one, and you can actually find the PDF files of this on their website. One particular file that I had seen showed a map of Iraq, and it was mind-blowing to read. It turns out that the lower southwest portion of Iraq was on this map divided up into 9 zones, apparently for oil exploration, which in a lot of the minds of a lot of people is more or less the smoking gun that if it wasn't the decisive factor, it was certainly a big factor with regards to war in Iraq. Just wanted to call in to share that with everyone. Bob, thanks. This is a great show, and thanks a lot.
My pleasure. And, you know, I might add that is, what do you have to say about that, David?
Well, what's interesting is that this is where the right and the left met on the energy case.
Mm-hmm.
Judicial Watch is usually considered a very, very right-wing organization.
That's what I was going to say. They led the fight against President Clinton on the Monica Gate stuff, didn't they?
Exactly. But an interesting area where the right and the left meet is on issues of transparent government and secrecy. I wouldn't consider it an exclusively progressive position to demand that the government be more transparent.
And transparent's a fancy word for people can see what they're doing.
Exactly right, for no secrecy, correct.
Yeah. Well, you know, we only got a couple minutes left, but one thing you mentioned, we talked before the show, that's worth mentioning. Tonight on Showtime, which is a cable channel, a pay-for cable channel owned by Viacom, the second largest media company in the world, a huge conglomerate, they're going to be airing a program called DC 9/11, and this is going to be a heroic look at President Bush and how he responded to the 9/11 attacks. And in lieu of our very first call about the entertainment meeting and its liberal bias, what do you make of this, David?
Well, I would say in many ways it's without commenting on the content or whether President Bush's behavior on September 11th was admirable or not. I don't really have an opinion on that. What I think is the most important thing here is you have a new step in how partisan or ideological some of our media is now becoming. So you have Fox News, which attempts to cloak its right wing agenda in the slogan of quote unquote fair and balanced. Okay, so that was step one. Now you have a television station which is airing a movie which it knows was written by somebody who identifies themselves as an ardent Bush supporter and conservative. You're having a television station air the product of this person under the guise of an objective look at September 11th. This is a new step, and I would call it a new low in the propagandizing of American media.
And if I can add to that, the same company that's putting this on the air is aggressively lobbying Congress now for huge changes in the media laws allow it to get much larger and more profitable.
And if you want to even go further than that, Congress, it appears like it has in the House something has passed on the FCC issue. In the Senate, there are some Republicans and a lot of Democrats who are supporting something on the FCC issue. The main blockade to forcing the FCC to keep media ownership rules is the White House, which has made grumblings that it's going to veto any bill to overturn the FCC decision. So let me just clarify this. You've got a company that has an interest airing a pro-administration piece of propaganda at the very same time that that company is hoping that the administration vetoes a bill before Congress.
Yep, that's an interesting situation. We've got a couple callers. Let's try to get to them both before the show ends in a couple minutes. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Right. it's easy to think that maybe this docudrama or whatever they're calling it will be dismissed because of the way it characterizes the relationship between Cheney and Bush, which I gather it sort of has Cheney fawning over Bush in some way. I don't know if that's quite the right word, but that's the posture that our vice president rarely finds himself in. I think he's well, anyway. But what I wanted to call about was actually the problem with PBS that I have. And last week they ran three New York Times people talking about germ warfare, and they took a lot of material from Judith Miller, who is compromised in so many ways within her own organization. And so it just bothers me that the premier investigative journalism show on PBS is actually participating in this in a more subtle way than the networks are.
Yeah, let me let David.
Frustrating.
Yeah, let me let David answer that. Thanks, because we have one more caller.
No, I would say real quick on the whole PBS and NPR. The fundamental assumption that PBS and NPR are quote unquote liberal, I think, is not that your caller was assuming that, but is sort of, if you really look at it substantively, like your caller has, I would say that it's probably not liberal at all. I would also say that. In when people say, well, the liberal media has NPR and PBS, I think the fact that if you look at audiences of PBS and NPR, they are a fraction of what the corporate network audience is. So as much as PBS and NPR can affect news coverage, they are far outweighed by the corporate behemoths like NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox.
Let's go to our final caller, Monticello, line 2. You're on the air with David Sirota.
Hello, this is Monticello.
Bonjour.
I had a question. Why isn't there as much examination of the concept of Zionism as there is of Islamic fundamentalism in the media?
Okay, that's our last question of the day. David, there you go.
Well, I think I think that what you can say about media coverage of the Middle East is the following thing. I would say that right now you've got serious coverage of both the Israeli side and the Palestinian side, and I would say that there have been questions on both sides about whether coverage has been fair to either side. I mean, the Israelis are regularly demonized as these warmongering people who,
in the news media?
I would say the New York Times and a lot of the main papers have been pretty harsh on Israel. At least not their editorial pages. I would say that their stories. They've done a pretty effective job of talking about Israeli atrocities. Now, they've also done a pretty good job, unfortunately, at propagandizing the Palestinians as being all of them being terrorists who want to just kill all Israelis. I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say in this situation, and it's sort of similar to the Cuba America situation, is there is so much propaganda on both sides of the issues that it's very hard to figure out exactly what's going on. Every single thing that you read, you can bet, has some sort of political perspective.
Well, David Sirota, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today in Media Matters, and we'll be sure to stay in touch with you in the future. I want to thank Brett, my engineer. I want to thank Andrew and Victor, who produced today's show, and Juice McPickles and Hambone for always being there. Be back in 1 week with Danny Shecker. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much, Bob.